Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production in association with City News.
We can all agree that the climate era is already radically changing our world. The question is, what is it changing it into? And how will it change Canada? And I'm not speaking here of the self-evident stuff, the higher sea levels, the natural disasters, the heat waves, all the terrifying things we've covered. I'm asking, what kind of country will Canada become as the climate era slowly remakes the world? Climate migration is happening already, but the sheer scale of what's coming, as some places around the world are transformed into uninhabitable regions, is staggering. Billions of people will need to move to survive. Where will they go? The answer depends on who is ready to take them in. Who is ready for climate migrants to help reshape their nation? This is not a story about how Canada somehow comes out a winner on climate change. There are no winners here. But there are countries that can lead the way into the future of human migration, and they can show the rest of the world what our future could look like. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Parag Khanna is an academic and an author. His new book is called Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. Hello, Parag.
Hi there. Nice to speak with you.
It's nice to talk to you as well. Why don't you begin, because your book is so comprehensive, maybe give us the big picture of the future of migration around the world.
Wow. Well, first of all, you know, this is a book about the future of human geography, and migration is part of that, but everything from our species adaptation to climate change to our ethnography and mixed race marriages, all of that is human geography. So migration, I like to say, is sort of like meteorology. It's like taking the temperature, you know, how many people move from country A to country B this year or last year, right? That's meteorology. Human geography is like climatology, right? It's a deep science of understanding how we adapt and distribute ourselves around the world as a species. It's a planetary kind of consideration. So that's really what human geography is. But of course, mass migrations, past, present, and future, are a really important and paramount lens for understanding human geography. And of course, a lot of the book is precisely about that. And the interesting part of the story is that whereas we think that we are now trapped and stuck and locked down forever as a result of this pandemic, the interesting and the ironic twist is that the pandemic struck at precisely the moment when we had been climbing higher and higher in terms of the number of people crossing borders and relocating and you know, shifting every single year, every single century, you might say. So I made this argument before the pandemic, and I have don't feel in any way, shape, or form compelled to change it, that if you look at each century, the number of people who relocate across, you know, away from their country of origin towards someplace new, the decimal point continuously shifts. It's gone from millions to tens of millions to hundreds of millions in the 20th century. And in the 21st century, more than a billion people will surely have to relocate or will voluntarily relocate because of a wide range of things, from politics to climate change.
Maybe let's discuss climate change for a minute, because that's where a lot of northern countries like Canada are looking at trends. And
may be wondering if they're going to be dealing with a massive influx of climate migrants.
Yes. So remember that Canada has become over time, not just, you know, recently, a mass migration society, mm-hmm. right? A very diverse population. Some say that Canada is on the cusp of becoming, quote unquote, you know, more brown than white, right? And that's obviously not as a result of climate migrants. That's a category of migrants that's really just getting started, but is a very large number. So Canada has taken on, and I praise Canada endlessly, you know, in the book for its generosity and its strategic demographic policy as a country that set out to increase its population by more than 1% every year, right? To bring in, 400,000 people plus. And the fact that it's doing so both on the basis of skilled migrants as well as political refugees and climate refugees, I think, is balanced and admirable. But that doesn't mean that Canada is going to be diluted or overrun. You're the second largest country by territory on the planet Earth. You're slightly smaller, but negligibly, let's say, for the purposes of this conversation, than Russia, but with only a third of Russia's population. So Canada has a vast space. It's not all livable, not all habitable. It's not all going to be verdant and agricultural. Mm-hmm. But Canada has become an agricultural superpower. You're investing in diversifying your economy. And in order to do that, to move from being a resource economy to a skills and services economy, you obviously need more immigrants anyway. So I think that Canada can easily absorb and become a population of 100 million people. And that's, of course, what your Century Initiative in your own country, which is a document and a strategy authored by Canadians. And it's perfectly plausible that 100 million people can live sustainably in Canada and perhaps a whole lot more.
What about climate migrants around the world? You know, you mentioned in an excerpt of your book that I read in National Geographic that this is not going to be a phenomenon confined to North America or even to Europe, but that it's going to be a massive influx simply from south to north. And I wonder about, you mentioned Russia. Let's start there. Is Russia prepared for this? I know Canada has a history of multiculturalism and immigration, Russia much less so. I'm trying to get a sense of how ready the world is for a migration on the scale that you're writing about.
And the answer is there isn't one answer, because Canada is really unique in terms of being a country that is having this open democratic discourse in your elections. This does not feature in the sense of being very polarizing or there being a significant amount of backlash, whereas Russia, not quite, right? Russia is a very, inward-looking, nationalistic kind of, society that's not ready to simply absorb tens of millions of utterly alien culturally peoples, right? So in many ways, Russia is the anti-Canada, even if you have a similar climate. But that said, unlike Canada, Russia sits and straddles, all of the major zones of Eurasia. Eurasia being the largest landmass on the planet Earth, the largest continent, with the majority of the human population. So Russia will inevitably, even as a place that's far less migrant-friendly, as a geography, as a territory, it better get ready to have a much larger population than it has today. Because if climate change, even the moderate scenarios come to pass, a lot more people will be moving north into Central Asia and into Russia. To some degree, that's already happening. So in the book, I report from Siberia. And yes, the winters are very cold. But the fact is that you can have a lot more people working in agriculture, industry, infrastructure, and other areas of Russia. And Russians themselves have told me that they really wish they had more migrants, because their population is declining very rapidly due to mortality, low fertility, alcoholism, emigration, you name it. So, Russia will inevitably have more people, and its own bureaucrats and officials and mayors and executives have told me that they actually wish they had more people. So that's not what you're going to hear Vladimir Putin saying in the Kremlin, in Moscow. Mm-hmm. But it is the attitude of the people who actually run the country across the country's vast geography day in and day out. So I do hold out, hope that Russia's attitude towards itself and its role in the world is going to evolve and expand in potentially constructive directions, even if it does remain, you know, geopolitically a very antagonistic country.
When we look at the scale of the migration that's coming, and you mentioned we're talking billions in the 21st century, what's the potential for political and even military conflict? Because, you know, I agree here in Canada, we've done a fairly good job at embracing immigration and multiculturalism, but we've seen, even as refugees make their way to safe countries now from other countries, that there's some pushback there, and there's certainly some anti-immigration sentiment in Canada right now.
There is. And, you know, you can have anti-immigration sentiment in America. Mm-hmm. It's had an administration dominated by it. You can have it in the case of Britain with Brexit. And ironically, perversely, what you'll find, and this is actually hopeful in the end, is that despite all of that, you'll have rising migration nonetheless. Huh. And the most recent U.S. census bears this out extraordinarily clearly. Under the Trump administration, during the Trump administration, under his watch, America became more diverse, more Latino, more mixed race, all at the same time. And we will look back 10 years from now and say, Trump who, when it comes to the demographics and the diversity of American society. And that's a good thing. Britain today, it is easier to migrate to Great Britain today than it was 5 years ago, than it was before or immediately after Brexit, because they've realized that they actually have massive labor shortages. In fact, they're experiencing them right now as we speak. They need 100,000 just truck drivers. They need 100,000, let alone all of the other sectors. So what happens is that even if you are a country with populist politics at the moment, it doesn't mean that that's actually your long-term trajectory or long-term policy. In fact, what you find is that when in the grand scheme of things, supply and demand for labor is what ultimately dictates immigration policies and patterns a lot more than the political populism that tends to grab our attention and headlines. And that's, of course, a very good thing.
So if this is inevitable, regardless of public sentiment, what should northern countries be doing right now to prepare for it? It sounds transformational.
Well, yes, but again, you know, it's hard to generalize about northern countries in the same way that it's hard to compare Canada and Russia and find a lot of political similarities. You wouldn't, right? Mm-hmm. But it is important to have role models of countries that are ahead of the curve in attracting the hardworking, young, industrious taxpayers and entrepreneurs and construction workers and caregivers and teachers of the future that they lack. And there you can see a huge contrast within the so-called West, because Canada and Germany are quite different in the way they're approaching this than, say, Britain or America. And very often in our conversations, Britain and America are taken as representative of the West, but they're absolutely not. I think Canada and Germany are much more. So in your two cases of Germany and Canada, you are increasing your labor force. You have significant inward migration, you have vocational training, you have strong assimilation policies, your economies are growing on the back of growing numbers of migrants that are spread across the economy. That's what you want to see happening. And quite frankly, when I look at the West as a whole, I don't see xenophobic anti-immigrant populism characterizing the entire West. I see what Canada and Germany are doing. I see Britain completely reversing course on its migration policy. So I see pragmatism. Again, supply and demand ultimately wins.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
So let's talk about Canada specifically then. You know, you mentioned Canada has a tentative plan to be a country of 100 million people, and climate change will continue to reshape the world while that happens. So how different will Canada look? And I don't mean necessarily the color of people's skins. I mean, as a country, as a geographic country, when we get to the end of this century.
I think it's a very well-articulated question, because Canadians themselves, and this is something I talk about in the book based upon various studies or surveys, you know, of Canadians, don't really spend too much time thinking about your vast northern expanses and their utility, you know, and even, you know, and so on. Whereas in the coming decades, you would surely become much more familiar with them for their utility, access to the Arctic and shipping lanes and resources, potentially locations for human settlement and habitation, you know, new geographies of agriculture, as I mentioned earlier, new infrastructures that will be built to service those new economic territories and terrain. All of that is happening and going to happen and going to accelerate. And that is going to really create a new map, not a new geological map of Canada, but a new functional map of Canada, how you use it and how familiar you are with your own country. And I think that's actually a really remarkable and interesting process that's underway. I mean, as someone who's, you know, trained in geography and really appreciates geography and thinks of geography not as something that's just fixed and static, but rather I kind of live by this motto, it's a punchline from the book, geography is what we make of it. Hmm. And Canada making the most of its geography is literally one of the great human, you know, stories of this century.
I'm fascinated, obviously, by what happens to northern countries like Canada. But I also just want to ask you, what does it look like then near the equator in 20 or 30 years? I mean, yes, tremendous amounts of migration. We're not going to abandon that land. It's not going to be completely uninhabitable, is it?
No. Well, I mean, you know, the equatorial regions are not necessarily as bad or as poorly kind of situated as other regions that are more extreme, you know, in their location. So, I mean, I live on the equator right now as we speak. I'm at 1 degree, you know, 15 minutes north latitude in Singapore, and it's a tropical jungle, right? So it will rain and it will continue to rain. And that's a good thing in the sense that if you can divide the world in the future into two categories of geography in terms of suitability for human habitation, there are those that have water and those that don't have water. So it's not even so much whether you are at the equator, it's, you know, are you in a desert or desertified location or a place where the water tables have completely disappeared and there's just no more groundwater, or a place where you have, you know, sufficient rainfall and reservoirs and irrigation and so forth. So that said, you know, in Singapore, obviously, you have to cope with rising sea levels, but rising sea levels are a risk north, south, and equatorial. So the places that are going to really suffer the most, and they already are, quite frankly, are particularly in South Asia, right? India and Pakistan. In Bangladesh, again, the problem is too much water. In India, there is a lot of drought, in Pakistan as well. In Iran, Middle East, Arab countries, and a number of African countries, North Africa, have already suffered extreme droughts. But of course, extreme droughts have come to the Western United States as well. It's called a mega drought, right? What's happening in the Western US. So places that are afflicted by drought are probably the ones that we have to be the most concerned about in the future, because even with large-scale water desalination projects, which are very expensive and behind schedule in many places, you know, it takes a long time to implement them. And it doesn't mean that people will want to stay there, right? You don't want to be dependent on a plant, on a big industrial plant to provide your water because there's no rain and no agriculture. That's hardly a stable, resilient situation for you as a person. It's more likely that you'll want to move. So the mass emigrations of the present and the future are most certainly from those geographies as well as others.
In terms of grappling with new demographics in some of these countries that will see a huge influx of migrants, a lot of cultural identity in Canada, at least currently, you know, is tied to the country for those born here, but also to the country of origin for many of the migrants. And is there a tipping point at which a new country becomes home, I guess, for a massive influx of new people?
Well, that is itself evidence of how identity is not singular. You know, identity is manifold. It's cumulative, as I like to say. It's not singular, because you have more and more people who still have ties, you know, and linkages and belief to their original homeland. And of course, the internet and technology makes it possible for migration to, maybe it's a physical one-way street, but it's not necessarily a cultural one-way street. And I think that is, a very, very positive trend that is happening. And again, you know, the term multiculturalism applies and is defended and debated more in Canada than any other country in the world. This notion of what multiculturalism means, and it's not going to mean the same thing everywhere. You know, to take the example of Germany again, they have a debate. And of course, it's worth looking at a country that is more representative of the cultural and ethnic homogeneity of, you know, Western European societies that of course have a very distinct, you know, and very kind of regrettable history of acting according to that. And the fact that today Germany has become a diverse immigrant society with a debate that they call Die Neuen Deutschen, the new Germans, right? And they're not saying, the question is not positing, how will you, the migrants, become like us, the natives? Mm-hmm. It's saying, what are the common aspects of being here, of being a resident here, that tie us together? And what do we all agree are the elements, the common elements of what it means to be a German in the year 2020, 2030, and beyond? And it's something that's being co-defined. And I think of Canadianness as something that's always being co-defined rather than as a fixed static thing. And I think that, you know, it's obviously far more prominent in America for people to have a singular cultural, ethnographic definition of what American means and to defend that. And I think that Canadians are less prone to that. And even those Canadians who may be prone to it probably accept the reality that you can't reverse the demographic, sort of diversity that represents the country today, and would probably take more pragmatic approaches to the issue.
I want to ask you a question that I've seen asked in other places to other people and has come off as offensive. And let's just state as the premise that climate change is an ongoing global catastrophe. However, is the premise of your argument that climate change is going to be good for Canada, at least?
Well, it is true that, you know, even though climate change is a worldwide global phenomenon, that we're not equally affected by it, you know, and therefore we don't have a common global approach, witness our climate diplomacy today, right? So, you know, in the countries are relatively worse or better off from climate change. That's just a fact. You know, again, some countries will have to be fully vacated and abandoned, whereas other places are what I call climate oases, because they're becoming more habitable and even comfortable to some degree. And that applies to Canada to some degree. I don't want to overgeneralize, because the climate is so fickle and finicky and indeterminate and chaotic, mm-hmm. That we are all also victims of climate change, even if there are opportunities. So that's probably the better way of seeing it. It's not that is Canada a winner, but are there opportunities, again, to diversify the economy, to brand oneself as a safe haven for people from around the world who can be contributors to your society and economy? Yes, Canada, you know, has that opportunity and is taking that opportunity. But the dynamic kind of management of that challenge is going to be a constant and complex exercise, right? It's not going to be easy because of, again, how volatile climate change is. And remember, you're also connected to the rest of the world. And so the disruptions in one place, even if they are, you know, cataclysmic, you know, ecologically, are still going to affect you, because you may be importing things from there and migrants may come from there and so on.
The last thing I want to pose to you is, you know, I'm not sure about you, but this period of time, the last 5-10 years or so, has felt extremely unstable politically, in terms of climate, in terms of obviously the past 2 years of a pandemic. And your book kind of indicates that this is a trend that, at least for the short-term future, is going to continue to accelerate. When you think about the big picture, how will this period look through the lens of history, assuming we're around to write it?
Well, I think we will be around. The question is how many people will be around, because we're actually reaching a demographic plateau. So the first and one of the most significant things for which this era is going to be remembered is the kind of tipping point in the global population. Because 20 years ago, we thought the world population would be continuously climb to 15 billion people, but nothing of the sort is going to happen. Instead, we're reaching what I call in this book peak humanity, The world population will probably peak at 9 billion people, which is far less than 15 billion people. Now, some might say that's a good thing for the climate, but climate change also is accelerating irrespective of that demographic peak. So the second major facet of today's life is, of course, climate change and the fact that it is so disruptive that it is pushing people, left, right, and center all over the place. And I had to conclude, the way I frame the book is that this is about, how humanity responds to the complexity at the intersection of this demographic peak, climate change, geopolitical disruptions, technological changes like automation and so forth. All of that is happening at the same time and slamming us at the same time. How do we as individual agents respond? And how do we scatter ourselves around the planet in search of a new kind of stability? And I foresee, that our migration patterns, our future, leading towards a future human geography are going to be so different from today that it's upsetting thousands of years in a way of geographical stability. And so that's obviously what I think this particular era is going to be most known for looking back.
Parag, thank you so much for this. Thank you for the book. And what a fascinating conversation. I feel like I learned a lot.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Parag Khanna, author of Move, The Forces Uprooting Us. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Talk to us via email, thebigstorypodcast, all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. As always, you can find this podcast everywhere you get podcasts, any app you like. You can also get it on your favorite smart speaker. Just tell the speaker to play The Big Story Podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.